Thanks everyone for coming along today to the weekly sales lunchtime seminar. It's my great pleasure to introduce Joe Shaw. Joe has held the Salveson Chair of European Institutions in the School of Law at the University of Edinburgh since 2005. And since 2018, she's also held a visiting position at the new social research programme of Tampere University, based in Finland. And Jo's in the final year of a Leverhulme Major Research Fellowship that develops the work that Jo is probably best well known for, which is her work on citizenship, citizenship practices and citizenship regimes. She's the author of a really quite vast body of literature on the subject, including her book on the transformation of citizenship in the EU, published by Cambridge University Press, and now with the forthcoming book this summer, I think, developing the work that Jo's been doing out of her Leverhulme project. Jo's also the co-series editor of the Cambridge Studies in European Law and Policy, amongst other things. But one of the reasons I know Jo is we worked together some time back in the early 1990s. And of all the publications, it's perhaps this little one that I am that always makes me think of Jo. It's a book called New Legal Dynamics of European Union, published back in the mid-1990s. I'm in it, Catherine Barnard's in it, a whole bunch of other, what were you, at that stage, relatively early careers academics.
Everybody had to be younger than me.
We're all involved in it. And remarkably, actually, how many people in this book are still active academics and actually still active in the fields in which they wrote on. So my chapter was on the free movement of goods, and I'm still writing on the free movement of goods. Catherine's was on employment law, and she still writes on that. And we all owe Jo a huge debt in terms of helping us start her career, our careers rather. So without further ado, Jo is going to talk to us today about the work she's been doing on the populist challenge to constitutional citizenship. Thank you, Jo.
Okay, right, cheers. Well, thank you very much. Thank you to Kenneth for the invitation. Also, the invitation originally came from John, who I also worked with earlier on in my career many years ago. Not quite as many years ago as Kenneth and I worked together in Kiel. That wasn't an awful long time ago. Sorry, I'm just trying to get my own version of this presentation up because it has a few notes in here as well that are good for me. So when I said I would give this paper on the populist challenge to constitutional citizenship, I was still, so what is it? He said there were several options. But I can't find any of them. Oh, yeah. Here we go. It's all right, don't worry. Has that done it? Did that move it on? No? Sorry? Well, we can go to next. That will do it. But usually it goes, maybe.
Normally we don't with the mask.
Yeah. Anyway, that's right. Yep. So when I was still finishing off this book, and I thought, which I showed it the other day, and I stupidly clicked on the hardback, and it said 60 quid. that somewhat offended the audience. The book will publish simultaneously in hardback and in some sort of EPUB version, which initially will be £16, and eventually it should be paperback as well. But I've changed it around the slide so that the EPUB is the primary one, which is of most interest potentially to individuals. My idea was that I might present some chapters from the book, and that worked quite well when the book was still in draft. And I did present, in fact, this chapter at a conference in Florence on citizenship, and I got some very useful comments on it. But I've now realised that actually, with a book, with a book that's now, I can't change it anymore, but I've yet to sell it. It's a bit of a stupid time to be presenting something from the book, because you can't, the pre-book tour isn't really very exciting. It's much more exciting once you finally actually get the book in your hands, and I see that it now says correctly the 2nd of June. That's what they've told me as well. So everything is, all the ducks are lined up in a row there. But I will take the indulgence. Nope, that wasn't work. That doesn't work. That does work. Finally found one that makes it work. I will take a little bit of an indulgence to tell you a little bit about the book and where this fits into this, because it's quite important. The whole to understand it in that context. The whole project is somewhat broader than my original training in European Union law, but not nonetheless. I think it bears some similarity to it, in the sense that it's an outgrowth from my long-term interest in how different legal systems rub up together or rub against each other, particularly when we think about it in a multi-level governance context. But in order to get to that point, we have to get to part three of the book. Parts one and two of the book basically set the scene and then take the reader through a lot of interesting ruminations on the underlying puzzle, which is, it's quite strange that although people often say citizenship is fundamental to the character, sorry, constitutions are fundamental to the character of citizenship, but actually, firstly, there's a political puzzle, or a legal puzzle, in the sense that actually relatively few constitutions actually deal with citizenship in any lengthy and detailed way, and this is true about Europe. It's also true across the world. It's not just, there are exceptions to that. Latin America, the substantial regulation of citizenship in Latin American constitutions. The most famous counterexample to this is, of course, the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And there are bits and pieces about constitutions that are of varying levels of significance in European constitutions. The German Constitution, Article 116, contains quite a lot of interesting material about loss, there's material about loss of citizenship, but there's also material in the German Constitution relating to the reacquisition of citizenship by those who lost it in circumstances of a profound lack of justice in the run-up and during the Second Two and during the Second World War. So that's the legal puzzle, the academic puzzle, if you will, is why nobody's ever even bothered to write this book before. I only wrote this book because I went looking for it and couldn't find it, so I thought, well, I'd better write it to try to bring constitutions and citizenship into conversation with each other. But all of that is leading towards part three of the book, in a sense, of which this is one chapter, The Populist Challenge to Constitutional Citizenship, Closing the Discursive Space. And secondly, the shifting spatialities of citizenship. Because that's asking the obvious question that anybody would write about if they studied how constitutions and how citizenship interrogate each other, if they interrogate each other, is why and how does this matter? Does it matter at all? And if so, in what way? And so there's an awful lot in this book of what political scientists would call selecting on the dependent variable, looking at things and saying, oh, that's interesting, I'll pursue that a bit further, instead of making claims to sort of scientific selection or rigorous deduction or whatever. We live in a populist moment, but we also live in a globalist moment. So how do these two classic moves or turns, how do they interrelate? And so consequently, by writing two chapters addressing each of those two turns, the populist challenge to constitutional citizenship, the closing of discursive space, which I'll talk about a little bit today, and then the shifting spatialities of citizenship, which is me on much more familiar territory, talking about EU citizenship, talking about the implications of Brexit for EU citizenship, talking about also international human rights regimes, which, although I'm not an expert in that area, nonetheless, I probably know more about than some of the other things I've prattled on about in this book. And the impact of fragmentation of the state within the state as well. So also, the multi-level governance at the sub-national level as well as the national level and the supranational level. So that's me on much more sound ground. And addressing in that context the sort of conundrum of why does this all matter, I make a fair bit of use of an American, I suppose she's a, you'd say she was a political theorist. I make a fair bit of use of Jean Cohen's work. She talks about quite a lot about how the paradox of the modern state, and you can include in this very much so the modern European state, is that in the pursuit of a bounded membership regime, one also runs up against the paradox that this leads almost inevitably in all circumstances towards a thicker ethnicization of concepts of membership as well. And to ask the question, is it possible, what types of governance regimes and what types of theories of citizenship might somehow provide us with an answer to the sort of question of, why citizenship is supposed to be about equality, it's supposed to be about justice, but it's always, whenever it promises, it also equally disappoints. Is there any way of thinking about citizenship in the context of the simultaneous move towards populism and the closing of discursive space, yet globalism and the opening of discursive space? Is there some way of trying to reconcile those two sets of questions? And in essence, that's the scheme of the book. Starting at the beginning, if you will, just briefly sketching out how I get to that point. I drew. I'm not sure it's right to say inspiration from an interesting quotation from Lord Justice Laws in the case of G1, which is one of the fairly well known deprivation of citizenship cases in the UK. And as I'm sure most people know, is that flashing light? Can we do something about that, or is it just?
Unfortunately, this is part of the set. It's just fading.
Sorry.
It's just fading.
All right, but we can't stop it from flashing. Is it driving? Is it driving people mad? It's okay. Sorry.
I think we'd have to turn off.
Okay. We'd have to go dark. Yeah, that wouldn't be so good either. Yes, he. Citizenship is not constitutionally regulated in the UK until the 1948 British Nationality Act. It was essentially just a common law principle of jus soli, so citizenship was passed by birth and territory. But of course, it wasn't understood as citizenship in that context. It was understood as being a subject to the crown. And even though that had morphed as the UK's constitutional monarchy had morphed, it morphed away from a sort of an individual allegiance to the crown to an allegiance to the crown as a body corporis, as an institution, as opposed to as an individual body of the king in a corporeal sense. Citizenship has never been constitutionalized in the UK, but it doesn't stop judges from somehow imagining that we can make some constitutional statements about it. Now, we get many examples in recent years, perhaps most famously the prorogation case last year, of judges talking in a constitutional register about things that haven't been given formal written form in the UK constitutional context, like around the sovereignty of Parliament and that instantiating the principle of democracy and so on. And this is a similar example of a judge saying that these are the conditions of constitutional citizenship. So the conditions on which citizenship is conferred, withheld, or revoked are integral to the identity of the nation state. Well, if Lord Justice Morse thinks the UK is a nation state, I find that quite an interesting proposition in and of itself, but that's a different discussion to be had. It's more likely to be a state of nations than a nation state, but anyway. Going on, they touch the Constitution, for they identify the Constitution's participants. And he used that as background for justifying his interpretation of the UK's rather restrictive and swingeing loss of citizenship legislation, the deprivation of citizenship applied to those who are suspected of involvement in terrorist activities. But nonetheless, it's a very interesting judicial statement about the concept of constitutional citizenship that bears much. It's unusual, I think, in the UK context, but it's worth certainly interpreting extensively. So that gave me the sort of push towards interpreting, towards studying citizens and constitutions together, and to also to finding different ways to study them together. And I just want to make one more sort of preliminary point here before going on to discuss the relationship between citizenship and populism. And that is to say that there's no such thing as just interpreting concepts that underpin the modern state. So whenever we engage in the process of interpretation, we're also engaging in the process of normative reconstruction. So as scholars, we might say that I'm not proposing a theory of citizenship. That is, I am not suggesting that these or those are the appropriate bounds of the membership relation. That's not what I'm trying to do. However, I'm aware that when I talk about citizenship in polities, once I finish talking about that, inevitably those concepts, those fundamental concepts of the modern state, the modern polity, and the relationships between them are not untouched by that process of normative reconstruction. And I think that's an important caveat that I should give in terms of saying, here I am as a lawyer who takes a broadly socio-legal approach to these sorts of questions. I recognize that that process of interpretation is itself also a process of reconstruction. So why populism then? I think I've already tried to explain that it's paired in the book with another chapter on shifting spatialities of citizenship. And it's an interesting question because populism is a style of politics that operates, or can and in fact typically does operate, to close down the space in which citizens can operate as free and equal political agents. So populism impacts on citizenship, not just because populist governments, for example, might change the definition of citizenship and make it more ethnic, so particularly including external citizens, for example, who have only the weakest of links to the home state. Populism may also be paired with a thicker conception of citizenship in terms of the types of values that states try to instantiate in the process of naturalization, becoming a citizen. But equally, populism in many ways closes down that discursive space because populist politicians claim to speak in the name of an authentic people, a part of the people, the will of the people, which we heard so many times in the context of the Brexit debate. And so consequently, we end up with a situation in which certain groups of formal citizens are more excluded from the political domain, precisely because they're not seen as part of the natural people. Now, populism is a a thin-centered a thin-centered ideology. That's what scholars of populism say, that you can't really understand populism unless you pair it. Typically, it gets more often paired with right-wing ideologies of nationalism, nativism, and exclusive approaches to political political sort of the definition of the proper scope of politics. It can be one of the interesting questions is the extent to which the relationship between populism and not liberalism, that's probably an antithetical relationship, but the relationship between populism and neoliberalism. Now, people often say that populist reactions within states are about domestic reactions to undemocratic liberalism in the international sphere. So the classic example, and here one has to take an example for Brexit because it's just so much the obvious one to take, which is to suggest that if one were to go, as I think Anna Menon tells this story all the time, if one were to go and speak to a group of people about the UK leaving the European Union might result in a lowering of GDP, the reaction of some people will be that, well, that's your GDP, it's nothing to do with me, because they would never use that word, alienated from that globalist sphere, if you will, in which there is not seen to be democratic control. That's a classic sort of move in which one can see happening in the context of Brexit. That having been said, populism is also tied in practice to neoliberalism in other sorts of ways, because one can see that many of the most notorious populist actors, such as Donald Trump, for example, is completely wedded to the neoliberal model in terms of understanding how that actually serves the interests of himself and those with whom he prefers to work in terms of both profit and also in terms of power. Now, Trump and Modi met together, and there's a lot. I think I said I was going to talk about India, but I'm not going to talk about India this time because there isn't enough time, and I've already whittled on for quite a long time. I'm just going to talk a bit about Hungary in a moment, but this is a really interesting article in The Guardian last week. Trump and Modi met, and this guy, I think, is a philosophy professor somewhere in the US, and he said that there is more to fascism than changing citizenship laws. Fascist movements seek one-party rule over the courts, the police, the military, and the press. They involve a cult of loyalty to a single leader and nostalgia for a mythic past when the nation was dominated by a privileged group. But the core of fascist ideology is realized in changing new citizenship laws to privilege a single ethnic group. This is why we regard the Nuremberg Laws, you all know what the Nuremberg Laws are, I'm sure, as a defining moment in German history, and the concentration camp as the defining Nazi institution. History has rightly been horrified by the Nuremberg Laws and their consequences. Why then are there so many countries going down this path? And I think in that context, he's obviously thinking about changes that are happening in India, which I write about in the book, but I frankly don't have enough time to talk about in detail here. But I'm trying to sort of reinforce how politically salient these sorts of questions about populism and citizenship actually are. So what's different about the populist challenge to citizenship? Several people, in presenting this material, a couple of people have asked me about, well, aren't you just talking about, I don't know, standard old ethnic preference rules, which there have been for a long time? What is it about populism that gives a strong, somehow a different timbre to what you're trying to talk about? And in that context, it's this problem of the people, which is central throughout the book that I've been writing about, looking for the people in constitutional citizenship. And that's, you know, that's what ties those two chapters together at the end, is these challenges of looking for the people at different levels of citizenship mm-hmm. governance. And my colleague Neil Walker has written a little bit about populism and citizenship, and I find what he has to say in that context extremely useful. It's so extremely useful that I want to give a quote from what he wrote, if I can find it, which I have in the chapter. So, here we go. Let me just read you what Neil Walker says, and I referred to him there about the unitary collective particular. That's a word that needs a phrase that needs a bit of unpacking. He says populism is neither a surface distraction from other deeper trends, nor wholly anomalous within our political tradition, an aberrant or extraordinary departure from modern constitutionally embedded politics. Rather, it can be seen as a product of and response to a series of stress factors that are intrinsic to the modern constitutional condition. Populist constitutionalism involves a reaction against what its proponents view as the neglect of the unitary collective particular in influential strands of modern constitutionalism. So in other words, and these are the following are my words, not Neil's, the grievance of the modern populist then is focused on her finding that modern constitutionalism focuses on individualism, universalism and plurality at the expense of collectivism, particularism and a unitary structure. That is, the populist objects to any characterization of the people within the traditions of modern constitutionalism, which allows the concept to frame an open discursive space reflecting competing and diverse tensions of history, geography, culture, society, law and politics. So populism is not so much non-pluralistic, it is, I think, in many respects, one can defend that the proposition that it's anti-pluralistic. And I specifically talk about it in the context of my this chapter with a number of case studies, the UK, because it gives me an opportunity to talk about Brexit, who wouldn't want to do that, well, probably many of us, the US, Canada, and India. But specifically in this context, I just want to talk a little bit about Hungary. Now, there's a huge amount of discussion about democratic degradation going on in Hungary, about the problem of a non-liberal, anti-liberal polity sitting at the heart of the European Union. Many people have also said quite a few bits of very important investigative journalism highlighting the fact that at the same time as being very anti-European, the same groups of people in Poland and Hungary and some of the other countries are also massively profiting from European Union funds. So one of the problems with the European Union, people might argue, and this could be one of the crises that continue to afflict it, is that it precisely feeds those groups that take advantage of the way in which it's set up in order to profit, and then to use that to turn that back onto the European, against the European Union, and to foster anti-European sentiment. Now, there's much that one can say about populism and citizenship in Hungary. I talk in the book more extensively about the paradox of the tension between liberal and ethnic citizenship in Hungary from 1989 onwards. But at the same time, it's delayed constitutional revolution until 2011, when finally Hungary passed a comprehensive post-transition, post-liberalization, post-Soviet, if you will, constitution. And at the same time, changed the name of the state. It's no longer the Republic of Hungary. It is simply Hungary. And the constitution talks about the concern of the Hungarian state, not only for those who are its citizens within its border, but also Hungarians wherever you find them. Of course, in the sense that's just standard ethnic preference, and you can find examples of that in many of the constitutions of Central and Eastern Europe, as well as in supposedly much more liberal contexts, like Ireland, which has an extensive concern for Irish people beyond its borders. Any country with a large diaspora has those types, tends to have those types of provisions in its constitution. The Americans are probably one of the few examples with a large diaspora that don't have any diaspora preference rules in the constitution. So you've had the redefinition of constitutional identity in Hungary. You've had the extension of external citizenship and also voting. So Orbán has, through various mechanisms, managed to make it simultaneously easier for those who become Hungarians by ethnic preference to vote, whilst making it more difficult for Hungarians who leave for job opportunities or study abroad to vote on the basis that the first group are more likely to vote for him and the second group are more likely to vote against him. There's been aggressive constitutional politics in that context, been very extensively studied with multiple constitutional amendments and the wiping away of an earlier liberal phase of constitutional court jurisprudence, which from 2011 onwards was no longer valid, or it was maybe something somewhat later than that. Now, a number of challenges, of course, come Hungary's way. One of them is being asked to participate in the burden-sharing arrangements for those who have migrated to the EU in the last few years, the so-called migration or asylum crisis of 2014, 2015, and various routes that would have led them through or into Hungary. And Hungary has installed barbed wire. It's also installed legal barbed wire to make it impossible for a person to be foisted upon Hungary without the consent of Hungary. So there can be no burden sharing unless Hungary agrees to it. And this is discussed in a decision of the Constitutional Court on the package of laws that is known as Stop Soros, which is partly about funding of civil society and also partly about the definition of the use of a constitutional definition to restrict the possibility that somehow collective solidarity might prevail over national choice, and that the Constitutional Court effectively defended the government's construction of this context, this understanding. Now, what's important in that context? And in a sense, this relates back to the point I made earlier on about the European Union being part victim, part complicit, part actor, part agent in all of this. I'm not quite sure which. I haven't fully figured it out in my own mind. Is that one of the techniques of Orbán's populism is to argue that it is not just Hungarians, but actually it's about the legitimate soul of a perfectly respectable stream of mainstream political opinion in Europe, which is Christian democracy, and so consequently Hungarians in constructing this framework are simply defending our way of life as through the means of Christian democracy. And famously, Orbán's party is still a suspended member of the mainstream Christian Democrat Party. And these are Robert Sehi's words: the greatest shift in Orbán's reconstruction of the people came with the migration crisis. Instead of simply associating the Hungarians with the people, Orbán elevated the people into the European sphere of action. Hence, he identified the people first as European people, we Europeans, and we the peoples of Europe. In other words, he has taken European integration and melded it into his own populism, thus creating a complex knitted together entity that is very, very hard to pull apart. Everything has become interconnected in important ways. So I'll shut up in literally 2 minutes. Conclusion, not conclusions, you know, conclusions, conclusions.
How do you spell that?
Sorry?
How do you spell
that? I've no idea. the point being that this is something I just need to stop doing. I can't present a chapter of the book and then what I need to do is to grasp the difficult metal that anyone who's ever tried to present a book or a PhD thesis or whatever is. I need to effect my elevator pitch. So I need to be able to say what's the point of the book in 2 minutes, and I need to be able to say what's the point of the book in 5 minutes, and for the 5 minute thesis or 2 minute thesis. And I need to be able to say what's the point of the book in like 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And it's harder to do that just through the mechanism of a single chapter. So these are not the final conclusions of the book, but they hint at some of the issues that I discuss in the final chapter of the book and in its conclusions. It's banal to say we're at a populist moment where we should be vigilant about the sorts of stories of peoplehood that are circulated. And we may stand at a moment where there's going to be a decisive erosion of the ideal of citizenship as based on equality and self-rule. Now that might lead us, as some writers might argue, to just junk citizenship and say citizenship is hopeless, we shouldn't bother with it. I tend to still take the view that citizenship is flawed, but it's probably the best instrument that we have through which we can invest these complex political balancing processes that we need to make. But that leads on to two types of problems that are themes throughout the book, and which I've only, in a sense, been able to hint at by talking about populism. So in relation to populism, what we've had is one or two examples of judicial interventions that have decisively undermined populist moves, both in the national context and in the international context. And in India, for example, I read yesterday that the UN's office is it the High Commissioner for Human Rights? I always get the UNHCR and the human rights mechanisms. I get those two confused, but they are two completely separate things. And this is the Human Rights Committee and Human Rights High Representative. Announced, and I think it's a woman, so I let's not say he, but they announced that they're going to make an intervention before the Indian Supreme Court about the Citizenship Amendment Act in India, which I would have talked about if I talked about citizenship, in the sense that trying to persuade, I suppose, the Indian Supreme Court to defend the secular character of the Indian constitution against the importation of religious tests of belonging that come in the context, that are coming in the context of the amendment to the Citizenship Act in India, the Citizenship Amendment Act of 2019 that came into force right at the beginning of this year. And there are judicial interventions, and they're happening at different levels, both within the state and in supra-state contexts. But there's always that question of what type of output legitimacy do those types of interventions have. If you have characters like Orban effectively co-opting the concept of Europeanness in order to defend their own particular national populism. And then if we talk about the problem of judicial interventions in this context, even more so, then we need to think about the problem of input legitimacy into judicial institutions. And this is a theme throughout the book, which is the question about non-majoritarian institutions. As lawyers, we're taught with our, as it were, with our mother's milk, that courts are central to our understanding of what law is, and also what law ought to be. And the is and the ought are very closely associated in ways that sometimes I think undermine our capacity to understand that our processes of normative reconstruction also have implications for justice and equality and other such important concepts.
In that context, some defenders of populism promise the reinvigoration of democracy through populist practices. Is there any real evidence that we can see that happening in the present time? So that's it.
Yeah.
There you go.